from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll find out about how art and autism connect.
I'll get a preview of this year's Installation Nation event.
And I'll check out the annual Stutz Artist Open House. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. The Hands in Autism program at the IU School of Medicine and Riley Hospital are hosting an art exhibit for works done by individuals with autism spectrum disorder. Sharon Gamble invited Dr. Naomi Sweezy to tell us more.
So, Dr. Sweezy, before we get into the art part, I bet I'm not the only one who needs a little help defining autism spectrum disorder. Can you give us as much of a layman's definition as you possibly can on that?
Sure. Autism spectrum disorder is, as the name connotates, really a huge spectrum in terms of a disability. What it usually is meant to presume is that individuals have challenges with communication and socialization, and oftentimes have very repetitive activities and interests. So the individuals on the spectrum, like I said, can really range quite a bit, from individuals who are intellectually on par with their peers to individuals who have more intellectual disabilities and challenges with academic work and functional coping skills. But individuals can also be verbal. They can be nonverbal. Some have a wide variety of behavioral challenges, and some don't have really many at all. So, as I said, it's really a large spectrum that oftentimes we can detect quite early in life, but oftentimes isn't diagnosed until later because it's somewhat of a hidden disability. It's not one that you would cross somebody on the street and say, aha, they have autism.
Sure.
And so one of the reasons that we've wanted to do this event is because they also have hidden strengths.
Right, right. Just that little tiny description about their often repetitive behaviors. Man, that's useful if you're an artist.
Exactly. So a lot of these individuals are very, very detail-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
What's oftentimes touted about them is that they can be very distractible and that they don't have a lot of attention to various tasks. But if you present them with something that they are quite interested in, whether it be a topic, a character, or something of that nature, then they can be extremely focused and do that activity for hours on end.
I want to come back to bigger picture subjects, but the focus and the intent makes me want you to describe these absolutely charming pipe cleaner characters. They're about as big as your hand. And tell us about the young lady who designs these and how she was inspired to create these.
Yeah, so this young woman is in her 20s, and from her parents' report, she spends a lot of time in developing this art, which you can see with the amount of detail, how it would take, you know, oodles and oodles of hours to create these. She's really inspired to do this art based on Sim characters, which are part of a video game that she likes to frequent when she's not engaged in pipe cleaner art.
Like an alternate reality.
Exactly. Exactly.
Ah. And you said her mother says, oh, she has hundreds, thousands.
Right. So they've shared about 30 for the show, and they're all incredibly detailed.
They're so detailed. I'm holding a little character called Marlin.
Correct.
And he has the most distinctive face. I mean, you know a lot about his personality from his face, and to be able to achieve that in pipe cleaners is astonishing. He has a handlebar mustache, and he has a long, pointy white beard, has big brown eyes. He's wearing a tall magician's cap with a half moon on it and a black band and a long blue robe with a gold sash. He has detailed shoes. Even his hands are detailed.
Right. And they have personalities, too. So you can see the personality, but then this young woman also indicated that Marlin is much, much nicer than Merlin. So apparently there's a Merlin that we don't have as part of the show, but they're
kind
very distinct.
Kind of an alter ego. Yeah.
Exactly.
Is part of... And this is the first year for this.
Correct.
This project is part of your getting the word out about it and getting artwork in, an opportunity for the artist to tell why they do this artwork, or is that something that people will maybe be able to just talk with the artist when they come to the show?
Right, both. So we do want them to be able to express in ways that are natural for them. Mm-hmm. And that's part of, you know, working with individuals with disabilities in general, but definitely with autism, is that because it's a large spectrum, they're all going to have individual strengths in terms of their communication. And some, you know, are having lots of challenges with that. Some don't talk at all. So we want them to be able to express by showing their art. But then some of them will have speakers who are individuals on the spectrum who will talk more at length. We'll have some who are, in fact, this woman who creates the pipe cleaner art, she will be sitting and demonstrating. So that's how she'll express and show what she does. They've also, some of them have been interviewed so that we can put that in a virtual format later and also be able to show part of that during the show. And some have scripted out and written with help of their caregivers. Some of their thoughts on their art.
We're having this conversation about 3 weeks before the opening of the exhibition, and to date you have artists from age 8 to...
Correct, from age 8 to 28.
Mm-hmm. And about how many artists at this point?
There are about 15 to 20 at this point.
Yeah, so there may be more by the time you hear this conversation or by the time you go to the exhibition.
Exactly.
And you've gotten... a collage artist. Tell us about the young woman who made the Kind Prep School Princess. I love her. Love her.
Correct. So this is a beautiful mixed media piece of art with little wallpaper cuttings that have been glued on and then painted over. And the young woman who designed this said that she was inspired by some Asian art and really made the shape of the face and the shape of the eyes inspired by that Asian art. And that basically the 16-year-old essentially wanted to put something in her art that indicated being happy regardless of your disabilities or your challenges.
Yeah, love that. A way of controlling the world, which regardless of what disability you have, and we all have something.
That's right.
You know, we're all trying to find a way to control, make the world happier, right?
Exactly.
There is a young man named Andrew Brenner who's made this. It almost looks like a caricature of a person. Do we know the story on this one?
No,
we'll have to come to the show to find
the
out.
Story
yeah.
about that
it's,
one.
It's a red-haired person who's got some freckles and a devilish expression. So I want to know the story of that one. And then tell us the story of Blue Heart Sunrise. This is my favorite piece of the examples you brought.
Well, so Blue Heart Sunrise is also by a young woman, and she actually did a piece of art also called Fishy Wishy. And they both look to be with watercolor art. And basically, the Blue Heart Sunrise is to demonstrate hope and love, is how she described it within her writings.
And Blue Heart Sunrise you're looking over the mountains, which are a happy shade of green, and the blue heart is rising behind the mountains in an environment that clearly has a sky with some white clouds, but also some green clouds. So
right.
Green is very happy color for this artist. And Fishy Wishy, I love Fishy Wishy because Fishy Wishy has incredible detail, almost to the level of a pointillist painter. There's a great koi or goldfish, but he's surrounded by sea anemones, mm-hmm. sea urchins, something like that, and just amazing texture and level of detail. So is there a national movement, an international movement to explore more the intersection of art and autism spectrum disorders?
I wouldn't say that there's necessarily, you know, a large movement to that degree. I think that very simply our efforts here are to try to educate and provide people with tools and information in whatever forum and ways that we can do that. And very oftentimes you learn the most just by sitting back, observing, and seeing what the individuals do themselves. And mm-hmm. so, you know, we know that art is obviously a great way of expressing oneself, and especially for individuals who may have a lot of language but not know how to communicate effectively. And again, some don't have the language at all. So being able to, you know, show a little bit about themselves and express some of their hurt, some of their happiness, some of their various emotions that, again, oftentimes don't come out in the most socially acceptable way, really is providing an opportunity for them to educate in the best way that they know how.
What was when you started your studies in clinical psychology and clinical psychiatry, window into or door into getting more interested in autism spectrum?
I think really the opportunity to educate. I think that by nature I'm an educator, and there was a lot that clearly from the patients that I was working with who were on the autism spectrum, there was so much hope and so much possibility with these individuals and with their families, and their families were struggling so incredibly much in incorporating their children into family life, into the community life. And I wanted to see that get better because I understood how, you know, unlocking basically the spectrum or being able to understand a bit more about how these special individuals think and process information. If we understood that and took the mystery out of it, that our individuals would be so much better supported and be so much better in terms of achieving their outcomes.
So, again, I'm a layman, so forgive the breadth of the question I'm about to ask. But so is it – do you feel like autism disorders have become more common, or are we just getting way better at identifying them?
So I think that's a really difficult thing to answer. I think people are really, really definitely trying. But I think it's a combination of things that what we found with the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the classification system that we utilize, basically the definition of what classifies in terms of an autism spectrum disorder has expanded over the years. So that would be one reason. Another reason is that people are getting more education and more knowledgeable, and so they're feeling a bit more comfortable about making that diagnosis when they see it and understanding the impact of making an early diagnosis for that early education and early intervention, which is so critical.
Is it normally a parent who is the first to say, or is it a family a pediatrician, or what? Where is the connection normally?
I would say in most cases it would be the parent or it would be the family, because we know that we can see signs and symptoms of autism really even in infancy, the literature tells us at this point. And so families are definitely noticing that something is awry, but really where some of the challenges and some of the symptomatology becomes most apparent is when the individuals start going into their classroom settings and there's comparison with peers, there's more challenges and need for independence, and they're breaking away from their families where there's a comfort zone. And so you see with that stress and you see that with that added challenge, oftentimes a lot of the behaviors become more prevalent.
What do you want people to think or do or feel after they come to this exhibit?
Really, I hope and wish for folks to really have a different perspective on what the whole spectrum is, and that it is a wide variety, and really come away hopeful. It is a disability that is a lifelong disability, but it's also one that can be really well accommodated with appropriate therapies and appropriate interventions. So I want people to feel hopeful about not thinking so much about all of the challenges that our kiddos have, but more so thinking about all of the strengths and all of the beautiful ability that they bring to our communities and how they can participate more effectively if we give them the tools to do so.
Sharon Gamble with Dr. Naomi Sweezy. Fine art, mixed media, photography, and digital media will be on display from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Saturday, April 22nd and Sunday, April 23rd at the Simon Family Tower at Riley Hospital for Children at IU Health. There will also be an opening ceremony from 6:30 to 8 p.m. on Friday evening. That's April 21st.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Primary Colors Installation Nation is taking place this April 25th and 26th on the open grounds of the Indianapolis Art Center's Arts Park. This year, Primary Colors is leaving behind the shipping containers of the recent Installation Nations and fully embracing the artistic opportunities and challenges of transforming Arts Park into an outdoor gallery. Travis DiNicola spoke with the event chair, Patrick Flaherty, and event founder, Dane Sauer, about the event.
Patrick, Dane, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you guys.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Absolutely. So Installation Nation, always one of my favorite events that Primary Colors does. It's gone through a lot of different changes. Dane, since you're really the founder here of the Installation Nation and Primary Colors member for life.
Hopefully not for life.
What's sort of the idea behind Installation Nation? And because it has gone through a number of different sort of forms over the years.
Yeah, it has. The first time we did the event was 2011, and it was certainly not a new event. There had been other installation shows in town.
Sure.
But there hadn't been one for many years. And we saw a need for that. There was a lot of people in town, a lot of artists in town especially, who, mm-hmm. you know, were making installation art but really didn't have an outlet for it. And so we thought, why not? We were looking for another type of show to do after doing allotropy for many years and art versus art and that sort of thing.
Those are all different events that Primary Colors does. And Primary yeah. Colors is really sort of a artist collective, not-for-profit, run for the most part by artists, mm-hmm. promoting local artists.
It's exactly, you know, what Primary Colors is, you know, started out as and mm-hmm. continues to be. And so, you know, as the event sort of unfolded, we were looking for a way to make it a little bit different than some of the other installation shows mm-hmm. that people have seen. So we started off with the idea of using the shipping containers.
Yeah.
Which was kind of an interesting concept, and we ran that through for three events,
mm-hmm.
and then it gets awfully hot in a shipping container in the middle of summer.
It does.
And we found that it was sort of constricting, you know, that, yeah. you know, inside of the box was great, but, you know, after a while, outside of the box sounded pretty good too.
So. Yeah. Now, the shipping containers were a lot of fun. I mean, I have to say. I mean,
they were.
You know, they had their own constraints, as you said. But there was some really interesting work done. For a number of years, the show was down on College in Michigan, sort of right across from the Lockerbie Pub over there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and seeing the containers sort of dropped in the middle of that open lot and stuff, it was a pretty cool experience.
Yeah. And it was fun. It was tricky getting them all in there and, mm-hmm. you know, getting them placed. And, of course, we had lots of fantasies of stacking multiple containers and doing very dangerous things with them. But, you know, we're nonprofits, so we are limited in what we can do.
Well, you know, one of the things that I found interesting about that show, though, was that the installation, even though it was in the containers, was still essentially outside.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the time with installation work, there's, you know, sort of a preconceived notion that it's going to be, you know, in a gallery, in a space, inside, a little bit more controlled, maybe. And but yet, you know, taking even more outside is really what's happening now with the new Installation Nation at the Arts Park.
That's right.
Yeah, it adds a whole bunch of new elements. And when I say elements, it could be the elements.
Hopefully not.
Pat, Patrick, how did you get involved with this? I mean, with the Arts Center and your role there and connecting with these guys?
Sure. I was invited to join the board of Installation Nation last year, and I was telling Dane that one of my first board meetings, they were entertaining the idea of actually pulling this event from the calendar, and mm-hmm. I expressed concern, and that was one of the most reasons I had joined the board was I was really excited. And so I threw out there that if I was able to secure the arts park at the Indianapolis Arts Center, since I also work in the exhibitions department there, mm-hmm. would they consider, you know, giving it one more shot? And so long story short, we got the park. And one of the things that we decided was that we didn't want to try to raise the tens of thousands of dollars to get a crane to drop the containers back there. So that's part of the evolution of just going into the nature. But I basically have been moving this event forward with a committee of both Primary Color members as well as just people like Dane who are invested in the event as well mm-hmm. as some support staff from the Arts Center. And so it's really been a great team effort, but we've been meeting now for a little over a year. We did make the decision to do it a year later so that we could apply for some funding and things. And we've been really successful, and you know, we're really excited. We're presenting 11 artists or artist groups. Each of these artists are being paid for their efforts, which is really critical so that they can use this money to make something. But so I've been largely heading the effort, coordinating all these different efforts to try to make this event happen.
Well, this is actually something a little bit new, too, for the Arts Park. And I mean, I love the Arts Park, but most of the work there is more permanent. And I mean, certainly people get to walk through that area when they're there for Broad Ripple Art Fair or other events and stuff.
Sure.
But to have sort of temporary installations, right? I mean, I'm trying to think, have you guys done anything quite like this before?
Well, since the Arts Park was largely renovated in 2005, 2006, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly, and there was an initial push, they brought in some monumental sculptures, they brought in different things that have, you know, semi-permanent to permanent type standings. There's a Truman Lowe, Robert Stackhouse, some big names in art. But there were also some pedestals put in place where there could be a rotating sculptures. But as things have evolved, one of my challenges, I guess you could mm-hmm. say, is to activate the Arts Park with a very limited budget.
Yeah.
And so last year we had a big win in that Lee Littlefield came through and popped up sculptures for the summer. And this summer I have a little budget to bring in an artist from Michigan. And so we are kind of moving to exploring it as kind of an outdoor gallery space. But I am always looking for opportunities for the Arts Park, and Installation Nation just seemed to really present itself well to do this targeted, you know, short-term event that mm-hmm. brings a lot of life into it. It'll be the first thing in the spring, like you said, right before the Broad Ripple Art Fair. But we are moving and exploring these opportunities. I had Barbara Zeck, a local artist, did mm-hmm. a labyrinth in our park the mm-hmm. last few months because she had a small grant to do it, nowhere to put it. So it's not that just anything goes, but Installation Nation and the fact that Primary Colors had a need for a location and the Arts Park is, you know, it's 9.5 acres. We've kind of centralized the location so you're not wandering all over the place looking for these artists, but it really seemed to be a good fit.
And it's a 2-day event, so it opens on the 25th and it's on the 26th as well. How much time do the artists have to actually install their installation?
They can, in theory, you know, they could come out anytime at this stage of the game, but what we're pitching to them for the most part is that they'll install the week leading up to it,
mm-hmm.
and then we're actually, even though the event is 2 days long, we're not deinstalling until the following weekend. So these installations, rain or shine, will be weathering for a week. So mm-hmm. we're really hoping that we really hope people will come one or both nights. It's free,
mm-hmm.
Or I said nights, but it's actually during the afternoon on Saturday. But if they, you know, come to the event, but also come and check it out on your own, because as we all know, and going to openings, you know, we're going to have Danny Thompson Deluxe is going to be playing Friday night, where it's going to be kind of a party atmosphere.
Sun King Beer will be there.
Sun King Beer. We'll have some food, mm-hmm. you know, and then there'll be this free interactive activity. So there's going to be a lot going on. The artists will be there, which is great to get to meet them. But just like any good exhibition, you've got to go back at least one more time to see the actual work.
Sure, sure. Absolutely. So tell me about some of the work. That because I know you guys have Indianapolis artists as well as some artists from Ohio and Wisconsin involved, Illinois involved with this as well.
Yeah, one artist who's participated in almost every Installation Nation event is Jeff Martin.
Mm-hmm.
He is working on a piece that is called Barrelodons, and so that that should be interesting. I don't want to just describe it over there. I think I'd rather people come out and see that one for themselves. I've seen the sketches, and we've talked over his ideas for it, and it'll be like most of Jeff's work. It'll be playful in mm-hmm. nature, and not trying to beat you over the head.
Playful in nature could be taken a couple ways here. Because, I mean, you are gonna, you know, the artists are gonna be playing with nature. I mean, some pieces are actually gonna be installed in the trees or connected to the trees. I mean, mm-hmm. this is an outdoor event. I mean, you know, Patrick, as you said, it's an outdoor gallery.
It is. We did. You know, Jeff Martin. It's great to see like Jeff Martin and Andrew Balls, the people that have been participating in the event, coming back to it. But we did run the call in such a way that you know, anyone in a bordering state was eligible to mm-hmm. apply, because with the budget and the time frame, we just didn't really think that someone would want to come from California at the
sure.
stage of the game. Down the road, maybe we'll have an installation from every state in the union. But we did get someone from Wisconsin, a couple people from Illinois. There's someone from Cincinnati. So it is kind of exciting that folks are coming from around the area. But one thing that I'm really proud of is that we have the Indianapolis Art Center Teen Advisory Council is actually working with an artist from Bloomington, Devin Ballera, and it's really neat. We've got this group of teenagers that are kind of helping us ask questions as what do they want in art, and they've got on board. And they're actually, with these 10 other paid artists, they're actually working to create an installation based on litter and different things and that they've found around. But it's exciting to me that that's kind of part of the mission of Primary Colors, is to you know, facilitate interaction between visual artists and the community. And this is helping that next generation of teenagers kind of see what installation can be and going
right.
inside. So we've got professional artists. There's Heather Ramier is doing the one that you're talking about, where it'll be on the side of a building. There's Bridget Stouffer's doing a clothesline that she's actually hoping for some rain that week, because she's using a water-soluble graphite that will wash away. Mm-hmm. It'll be on a giant clothesline. She also has work, incidentally, in the Art from the Heartland exhibit, which just opened, which is a regional juried show, which will also be open that night. So it's neat to see some overlap between.
That's the exhibit that's inside the Art
exactly,
Center right now.
Yeah, mm-hmm. but there's really, I mean, there's going to be a giant kaleidoscope. There's going to be this clear plastic tubing way up in the trees that looks like it's almost kind of like intestinal, but it has to do with our connection to the systems. And again, you know, as Dane was saying, you know, we're going all out, we're going outside, and nature will play that. So people are going on the pergolas, in the trees, on the ground. One installation is just hundreds of teacups. And so it'll really, this is kind of an experimental year for all of us as we take this thing outside and just see what we get. But lots of variety and
I love the idea of the clothesline with the water-soluble, you know, paint, and that actually sort of hoping that you would get some rain, because that becomes an element in creating the piece.
Right, and I was talking to her and about it, and she's like, "Well, I'm actually hoping for rain." I'm like, "Well, you know, we have a difference there, but
later in the week,
Dane mentioned earlier, you know, you think, or you mentioned Travis, about installations typically being thought of being in a gallery or in a contained space, and this really ups the ante on that a little bit. And you know, it's a rain or shine event. We're all volunteers trying to pull this thing together. We were through great fundraising, which you can see all of our donors on the program when you come. We've had amazing support for this, so we are able to pay the artists, which is really important to us.
No, that's great.
But it's a gamble. But you know, we're not gating it. It's free. There's going to be activities to do. You know, you're going to be able to buy some Sun King if you want, or get some, you know. And we're also doing this large interactive activity where there'll be sections of mesh that people will be able to weave fabric through, and it's kind of the idea of an insignificant or kind of trivial action multiplied by hundreds or thousands of people can start to create this big form. And so we wanted to have something that people themselves could be part of, kind of an assemblage that wasn't, you know, was a little outside of the box.
Very cool. It sounds like it's going to be just a great weekend.
Yeah.
And stuff. And you know, being able to see each of the pieces individually, but also how they're all interacting with each other and with the crowds and with the art that's, you know, sort of the relatively permanent art that's at Arts Park as well.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. For me, a defining moment was when the draft of the map that we'll be handing out came to me, and that's when it was really like, we pulled this off. You know, we still got to get through the event, but at this point, you know, pretty much the ship is sailing. And so it was really cool to see it. And I like that too, that you'll be able to experience them individually, as well as kind of see one leading to the next, as well as, like you mentioned, the artwork. And then the gardens will all start to be coming up at that time, too. So,
you know, I have to say, I want to actually sneak up there during the week leading up to the event just to see some of the artists actually installing the pieces.
And you're, yeah, and as the Art Center is always, you know, is open 7 days a week, so is the Arts Park. And
yeah,
people are more than welcome and encouraged to go. We don't have a timeline yet,
sure,
as to when those artists are going to be installing, but, you know, check it in. We're right off the Monon Trail.
Yeah, the closer to Friday, you're more likely to see more action going
probably
on.
Probably a lot of activity Friday morning.
Yeah, yeah, very quick
afternoon.
Yeah, that's when I'd show up.
Excellent. Well, guys, thanks so much for coming into Art of the Matter. It sounds like it's going to be just a great show, and I'm glad that the Primary Colors is bringing Installation Nation back.
Thanks.
Thanks, Travis.
Travis DiNicola with Installation Nation's Patrick Flaherty and Dane Sauer. The event takes place at the Indianapolis Art Center on April 25th and 26th. More information is available at primarycolors.org, and colors is spelled the British way, so primarycolours.org. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon?
I heard this wacky study the other day that showed that people who owe money on their taxes are most likely to file on April 15th or request an extension. They needed a study to figure that out.
Really?
Anyway, you might have gotten a tax refund check recently, and we have some ways to help you spend it on our calendar we call
What'll We Do? Or if you had to pay, maybe just something to make you feel a little bit better.
There you go.
There you go. Hey, and this is a fun one to enjoy. It's a film festival that benefits the National Kidney Foundation of Indiana, and it is the Wet Your Pants Comedy Film Festival. That's right. After taxes, that's what you need to wet your pants. April 26th at the Georgetown 14 Digital Cinemas. They're showing 25 films, including 6 features, 19 shorts. All of the films hail from as nearby as Carmel and as far away as Estonia and Cyprus. And all the proceeds, again, go to the National Kidney Foundation of Indiana, and they are fun films. Basically, the films start playing at 10:30 a.m. and continue every 2 hours throughout the day, with the awards ceremony taking place at the final end of the day. Again, April 26th, Wet Your Pants Comedy Film Festival.
That is so wrong. I'm sorry.
You get more information at wetyourpantsfilmfest.org.
Of course, because no one else had that URL. Surprise. hey, this Saturday afternoon, if you're a fan of Ansel Adams, whether or not you've already seen the fabulous exhibit at the Idlejorg, put this in your calendar. Ansel and Me and Ansel's Martinis. It's a lecture and Q&A session with Indianapolis professional photographer Lyle Manweiler, who's going to recount his adventures in Yosemite with Ansel Adams and others. And he'll tell these stories. You can tour the collection, and that talk is included with your museum admission. So check that out at the Idlejorg Museum this Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock.
If you're looking for some folk music, you might want to check the Indie Acoustic Cafe series to hear John Gorka. He is very widely regarded as one of contemporary folk music's leading talents, very talented man, and he'll be performing at the Acoustic Cafe on April 26th. That's down in Fountain Square. He's also got a new CD out titled Bright Side of Down, and you get more information at IndieAcousticCafeSeries.com.
The new musical Spun opens this weekend at the Phoenix Theater. Following their father's death, 20-something estranged siblings Molly and Jesse try to find a way to reconnect with the ruins of their childhood. And it's full of some rocking out kind of music. It was actually originally developed about an hour away through Bloomington Playwrights Project. And it's open at the Phoenix Theater right now. More info at phoenixtheater.org.
If you're looking for something really completely different, you might want to check out Red Barat and DJ Kyle Long performing at the Jazz Kitchen on Sunday the 27th. You've heard Kyle Long on here before, and he's really into a lot of different interesting international world music. And Red Barat is a group, it's an 8-piece band from Brooklyn that is kind of a mix. It's like a hard-driving North India bonga rhythm with elements of jazz and go-go and funk and hip-hop, and they're going to be performing some really cool stuff. So if you're looking for, well, it's pretty much an ethnomusicologist's academic dream, then go check out this show at the Jazz Kitchen on the 27th.
Well, there we go. If you still have some money left from your tax refund after all that, or you're sad because you had to pay, then join us again next week for more great ideas on that calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
You know spring is in full swing when it's time to hear about the Stutz Artist Open House. Sharon Gamble invited fabric artist Wendy Franklin and jeweler Lee Dunnington-Jones to tell us what the annual event means to them as artists and how they get ready for it.
So, Wendy, tell me your first experience of the Stutz. Did you have friends with studios there? Did you come to the open house, or how did you become aware of the Stutz Artist Studios?
I think I must have seen a flyer someplace. I don't really remember, but I walked in about 8 years ago, and I fell in love, like three steps into the building.
Wow.
I just loved it. And then from that point on, that was my goal, to be in the Stutz. I just love the atmosphere, the old building, the hallways, the energy of the crowd there. So I went two times that first year. I went Friday night and then I went back again Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And I made it my goal to make my house messy enough that I could justify a studio at the Stutz. My house is still messy, but I have my studio, so it worked.
Oh, you are very creative that way.
Yeah.
Lee, do you remember your first encounter with the Stutz? You've also been
years
there for
and
a
years
while.
Years ago. Yeah. I came to the Stutz open house. This was before I really aspired to have a studio. I had been painting with my friend who graduated from Heron with me, and we had continued painting through our adulthood and childbearing and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided that we had stacks of paintings and maybe we ought to have an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And so we rented a studio together at the Stutz.
Ah.
And it's been a wonderful and growing experience. The artists at the Stutz, the camaraderie, the Wendy was saying, the atmosphere, the energy. It's just so cool to work around that many artists. And if there's something that you don't know or don't know how to do, you can go knock on somebody's door at any time and say, hey, how do I do this?
It's kind of like a dormitory, but for grown-ups.
A dormitory for grown-ups.
And you happen to have studios across from each other, is that correct? Oh, okay. How close are you to
one
another?
On the same floor.
Yeah.
Right, a couple hallways away.
So I'm curious, as a jeweler and a fabric artist, and I know, Lee, you were talking about painting, but you've evolved into doing jewelry as your primary art. Do you ever help each other, even though you're working in completely different mediums?
Wendy and I have not had that experience, but I have that experience with other people that are on my hall. And anytime I get stuck, or anytime anybody on the hall gets stuck, knock, knock, knock. Would you look at this and see what you think?
Now, tell me more about the Stutz. Is the Stutz a matter of the craft itself, of the mechanics itself, or is it more creative block, or is it both?
For me, it can be both, because part of my work involves engineering. A piece has to work on the body. Mm-hmm. And hang the way it's supposed to. So I have my trusty friend across the hall, Janet Marie, who is an engineer as well as a painter.
Oh, good.
And then I have all of my other trusty friends at the Stutz that I can say, does this work compositional-wise?
Do you ever get conflicting opinions?
Often, but, you know, sometimes work by consensus is good.
And Wendy, do you ever get stuck or just need a different viewpoint and go talk to some of your colleagues?
I do. I usually have my block is usually getting it from my head out to the piece. I usually know what I want in my brain, but sometimes it doesn't translate well into the fiber. So I have a couple good friends at Stutz that I call on, wander down, knock on the door. And then I use the men of Stutz, the actual men that work there, the maintenance guys, They help me out from time to time with technical type things. I'll drag them in and try to get an idea on how to do the engineering portion of things, because a lot of my work, it requires something kind of creative and different, but more from a technical hardware mm-hmm. type standpoint. Mm-hmm. So I'll call on them. A few months ago, I had the guys down the hall that have a production company and went down there, and I was doing a nude piece for a show in Florida and called all them down. And so it's always, there's always people around that will give you an opinion. It's great.
So is there kind of an etiquette? I'm kind of going back to my dorm room comparison. Is there kind of an etiquette when you're in the flow, you're in the zone, and you don't want somebody to knock on your door? Is there, do you just close your door and lock it? Is that how you keep your colleagues from coming and interrupting something that's in process? Or have you ever, maybe that's never happened?
I have pretty much an open door all the time that I'm there. People wander in. I've noticed since I've started keeping chocolate on my table, I have more visitors. So I think that's how I'll ration it. If I get to a point that I have a few too many, I'll stop putting out the chocolate
uh-huh.
or make it worse chocolate, not the good stuff.
Wendy's studio is a really interesting place to visit. There are just all kinds of textiles and textures and colors, and you want to just kind of touch everything, make a pile and roll in it. It's just rich to walk in to her studio.
So, Wendy, let's talk about how did you come to fiber and textile art in the beginning? Was that your first field you were attracted to, or did you come from some other area?
I had kind of a winding past on the art. I did silver jewelry and did street shows for several years, and I wanted to add some color to the silver.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in a little tiny knit shop in downtown Carmel, which has since closed, but I bought these little teeny tiny bags of wool to do the process that I do, which is basically laying out the wool on silk and under silk and wetting it down and rolling it and rubbing it until the fibers merge together. So at my kitchen sink, I did these little teeny tiny pieces to go back behind the silver, which actually didn't work well at all. It was kind of a disaster, but I really, I really loved.
But she's smiling as she
process.
Says that, I have to note. Yeah.
I really loved the process. So about that time, my kids were getting to that point in their lives. They're teenagers now, but they were starting to do a lot of weekend activities, and I was missing things, and I missed a breakaway one Saturday doing a horrible show in Kentucky, and when my son plays hockey, and I missed the breakaway, and I thought, I'm done with the street shows. So
sure.
I took a year off. I took some workshops in what I'm doing now, and went around to different shows and tried to decide what I wanted to do when I grew up, which is what I'm doing now, all gallery work and commissions and do that type of work. So it's much more, I'm much more busy, but I'm also much more flexible.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I ended up doing this.
Are you still working in wool, and are you augmenting it with other textures, with other materials?
I have really gone from more of the piece being mostly wool to the piece being mostly silk. So it's the same process. It's just a little shift in the materials. So right now I'm dyeing silk, laying it out over a fine bed of wool, and then a little bit of wool on top that makes the piece, and then it's mounted, all abstract contemporary type work. But primarily I'm focusing on the silk because of the luminosity and the color.
Where do you get your inspiration?
I get it all over the place. I'm really just a colorist at heart. So any color I see, I'm constantly stopping and taking pictures of rust and railroad cars and little cracks in the sidewalk and everywhere I look. It's just a color thing to me.
Have your kids started picking up on it and saying, "Mom, I saw this cool thing on the way home from school," or anything like that? Or are they too cool to do that? They're probably too cool to do that, aren't they?
No, they just think I'm crazy. The whole family does, really. because I get obsessed by color, and they tolerate it well.
That sounds like good parenting to me. You've raised them to be indulgent.
Right. I have one that comes and does all my organizing at the studios. She's good with working with artists because she's grown up with me. And my son comes and builds my panels and my walls and all that. So it's pretty much a family thing.
Fantastic. Lee, Wendy referenced a windy past, and you've had a windy past. I'm not talking personally. We'll talk. That's a different radio show. That's probably a Fresh Air interview. But artistically, you had a complete change in material. Not that long ago.
I had a complete change in material, but I've always been a 3D artist. I've been making things out of squished aluminum foil since I was 5. Building little sculptures and making things. And I was schooled as a painter. Light has always been fascinating to me. And structure and form as you can see it with light. So I still use that in my work, that same basic inspiration. But I translate it in 3D instead of in 2D. And I've always been attracted to natural elements, to the out of doors, woods and wood and trees and leaves. And so I use those kinds of textures a lot in my work.
Do you have a similar experience where you stop and you're taken by a shape or a texture and you just are, you're riveted?
Oh,
and you have to stop
and take it with me.
Oh.
I came home.
Warned if she comes to your house, folks.
No. I came back from Florida this winter. We spent a month, my sister and I spent a month with my mother in Florida on the beach. And I came home with a whole bucket full of sea textures, seaweed, the inside of a coconut husk, exterior of a shell, just part of a shell. So I make molds of these interesting textures, driftwood, mango root, and then put them. I've been putting them together in abstract forms and making jewelry from that.
You have a number of your pieces on today, and I see some copper. And what other materials are you wearing today?
Copper and bronze and steel is what I've been working with in the last probably 6 months. I've been working on mixing metal in the same piece, and it's taken a year of experimentation to get the pieces that I wanted, and finally all of a sudden everything clicked, the technology and what I wanted to do. I finally got the recipe.
Well, I have to ask about that, not having any experience, but I'm imagining that those materials melt at somewhat different
points. Temperatures.
Yeah. So
and so getting them to work together is a little bit difficult. But so I experimented for a year, and I've finally got pieces that work. I've been working in Mokumgane. That's three colors of metal that are pressed together. The Japanese do this in hard metal, but I've been doing it with metal clay, where I can mix the layers together and make patterns and designs. Sometimes they look like wood grain. Sometimes they look totally different, but so that, like in a ring, for instance, I will have stripes or different areas that have different colors of metal.
As we're having this conversation, it's about 5 weeks before the open house. Do you have enough work ready? Or will you be living in your studios between
That's
now and
the
then?
That's the $64,000 question.
I know that I'll be living in my studio. I've done 13-hour days every day so far this week, so I'll be there. Like that till the open house. No matter how prepared you think you are and how calm you think it's going to be the next year that you do open house, every single year there's something either exciting that takes your interest and you think, oh, this will be perfect for open house. But there's just that, there's that deadline that for me at least creates a lot of adrenaline, which I love. So that's perfect. I'm a deadline driven perfect person. So open house is the perfect time to just start really, really working and pouring the hours in.
Do you sometimes have trouble stopping work in time to make your studio ready for
I say every year that I'm going to quit making work a week before the open house so I can just concentrate on the details and the signs and all the little nice things that you do to make it look pulled together. Every single year, I'm pulling an all-nighter the night before the open house, finishing up a piece that I am convinced will be the best piece and cannot be not made for the open house every year.
Sharon Gamble with fabric artist Wendy Franklin and jeweler Lee Dunnington-Jones. The Raymond James Stutz Artist Open House is Friday, April 25th from 5:30 to 10:30 and Saturday, the 26th from 2 to 7. The event is at the Stutz Building. That's 212 West 10th Street. More than 70 artists are participating and artwork is priced from $12 all the way up. Your Friday night ticket allows you to return on Saturday. To get tickets, visit StutzArtist.com. Again, StutzArtist.com. And you can learn more about Lee at LeeDunningtonJones.com. That's L-E-I-G-H, Dunnington, that's with two N's, hyphen Jones.com. And you can learn more about Wendy, it's Wendy Franklin, at WendyFranklinArt.com. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll talk with an author from Fort Wayne about her new book about the Stuarts called The Girl on the Golden Coin.
We'll get a preview of an event that brings together Dance Kaleidoscope and the Art Museum.
And I'll find out about a whale of a musical at the Phoenix Theater. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.